You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, February 20th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live
to tape
in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, vacation week rolls on. I am celebrating my daughter's vacation from school this week by also taking vacation so that I can spend time cleaning her brother's diapers, feeding him food which he'll throw on the floor and at my face, allowing him to drool on me, wake me up at 2 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, and 11 in the evening for that matter. But why would I go to bed then when I know he's going to wake me up? But for you folks, we still have a great show. On the program today, interviews from my time at the Families USA Health Action 2014. John McDonough, director for the Center for Public Health Leadership, on the challenges and the process in which Vermont will set up its single payer. This is a fascinating interview, if you really like wonky stuff. Also on the program, Robert Craig, executive director of Citizen Action Wisconsin, on Scott Walker, who may be the biggest beneficiary of Chris Christie's corruption, until, of course, Scott Walker gets in trouble for his own corruption. But, you know, it'll be nice to be the front runner for a couple of weeks, I guess. Also on the program, Cheryl Phillips, Senior VP for Advocacy at Leading Age, on hot spotting and how it can help the elderly on Medicare. Very interesting stuff if you want to understand some important concepts in healthcare. And for members, ladies and gentlemen, something that is not wonky. Back in 2005, Triumph, the insult comic dog, the comic insult dog, came on the program with Janine and I in the old Majority Report. This is from the deep archives. And he basically crapped on us for 30 minutes. And then we heard from Robert Smigel for another 10 minutes after that. So it's great stuff. He's one of my favorites. Both Smigel and the insult dog. So members, you get that bonus. And if you're one of those freebies, you're like, wait, what? 30 minutes with Triumph and Sam and Janine? And then we hear from Smigel himself? Oh, gosh, I wish I could listen to that on my Majority Report app. How come I can't listen to it on my app? I hit the member log on. Oh, I remember. I'm not a member. That's why. Well, this is what you can do. After you get the app at majorityapp.com, you can just click on the Become a Member link at the Support the Show. Or you can just go to majority.fm, click on Become a Member, and become a member for chump change a day. And you get these type of bonuses. At the very least, you could support the show by buying your Amazon crap at our link, majoritycom. You click on the Amazon link. You bookmark it. You always buy your Amazon crap through there. We get a kickback. You notice no difference. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Give us a review on iTunes and become a member and enjoy this bonus for members today, that deep archive of Triumph, the comic insult dog. And if you become a member tomorrow, you can still have access to it. It'll all be on your phone if you want. All right, folks, tomorrow is Friday, the 21st, and that's a members-only show.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry. Wah, 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 wah. Lewis Lapham from 2005 on the program, and Viggo Mortensen, the actor, who is quite a political guy. I had forgotten about that interview, but it was interesting. So members, you'll have that tomorrow. And for freebies, we'll be back live on Monday, February the whatever it is.
Wow, though. Triumph on Thursday and then the whole Friday show for members only?
Matt, don't rub it in. Wow. Don't rub it in.
That's
not
a great week to
become a
member.
I know. It'll be great for members, but it's not going to be, you know, you're going to have a lot of people out there, freebies, who are saying, like, no, the 33 cents a day that I spend on nothingness is more important to me. And so don't make them, don't rub it in, okay? All right, folks. Enjoy the show. We're back live on Monday. Continuing our coverage, Families USA Health Action 2014. Joining me now is Dr. John McDonough. He is the director of the Center for Public Health Leadership at Harvard University, an author or a writer, I should say, online on health policy, been involved in many different health fights.
I also wrote a book on the Affordable Care Act called Inside National Health Reform. It's okay. Published in 2011.
Great. And we will put a link on ringoffireradio.com. So let me give us your sense of, I mean, as someone who literally teaches health policy, what problem, or I should say, what is our central problem with both delivery and cost of health care today? And how will the Affordable Care Act help that and also not address that?
Yeah. Well, we have a number of central problems. We have the problem that not everyone has security and financial protection under the system. And the ACA will go far in closing that deficiency and not completely eliminate it. So there will still be more work to do on that front.
What is open? What is the more work to do?
Well, so for example, after the ACA is fully implemented, we will still have somewhere around 25 to 30 million Americans who still don't have health insurance coverage, and how do we deal with that? I think even more importantly, with the affordability structure for people who go into the exchanges and get subsidized coverage, that the structure of both premium support and cost-sharing protection is really not adequate for an awful lot of people who will be looking to it for coverage. I worked in Massachusetts on the creation of Massachusetts health reform. If you compare the affordability protections in Massachusetts with the affordability structure in the ACA, what you find is that the Massachusetts structure was far more generous in terms of how much people had to pay in premiums and how much they had to pay potentially out of pocket than is the ACA. The ACA strove to be where Massachusetts was and found, because of the scores of the Congressional Budget Office, that was too expensive. So right now what we've got is we've got many, many more people who are signing up for Medicaid then are signing up for coverage through the exchanges, even though only half the states are part of Medicaid,
right,
and all 50 states are part of the exchanges. And why is that? I believe that some significant part of that discrepancy is because a lot of people are looking to it and finding that it's still not affordable for them.
Uh-huh.
And so my sense is that one of the challenges going forward for people who support the ACA is to reopen and readdress and restructure the affordability structure to make it more legitimately affordable for the people who are looking to that now as their only option for coverage.
Okay, because, I mean, there's been a lot of reports that of those who have purchased insurance on the exchanges, on the private exchanges, about only one-third were people who did not have health insurance before.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so
Too early to draw conclusions, but you suspect
that at least there's a certain percentage of people who are reluctant because simply we still have not achieved affordability yet. And so is this a question in terms of structure of simply adding more subsidies or tax credits?
Yes.
That's it. It's as easy as that.
Well, and lowering the extent to which people are exposed to significant cost sharing. Co-payments, deductibles, co-insurance,
okay,
that kind of thing. So both sides, you have to look at both sides of the equation, seems
so
to me.
Now, so the first side is to increase subsidies. The second part would be to say from a regulatory structure, like, look, you know, just like we say, this is a minimum a floor in which your the quality of your coverage cannot drop.
Yeah.
We're also going to sort of raise the conceptually,
yes.
So, we're going to cap how much co-pays or deductibles
can be. Right now, you get subsidies for the premiums between the low level, 138%, up to 400% of poverty. You only get protections on the cost-sharing side up to 250% of poverty.
The cost-sharing side?
The cost-sharing.
Oh, cost-sharing.
The
okay.
cost-sharing
okay.
side, but up to 250. And a lot of people in that 138 to 250 look at the cost sharing protections and say it's still not affordable for me in terms of what I have to pay out of pocket before I can get medical services. So part of it would be going back and addressing cost sharing protections for people under 250, but also expanding it up further because those folks above 250 need some protection as well. And, you know, the truth is I think it will be achievable without blowing up the financial structure of the law, because the truth is there are going to be a lot fewer people enrolling in Medicaid than was projected originally, and there are going to be fewer people in the exchanges. So
that's interesting.
So that provides...
Why are there fewer people in the exchanges? Simply
because
just by choice?
I think, yeah, by choice, but
okay.
I think it's largely the choices because they're looking at the choices and saying, you know, I appreciate that I now have some choices that I didn't have before, but quite honestly, at the end of the day, they're still not affordable for
me. That would be pretty ironic if the refusal by Republican, largely Republican, I think almost exclusively Republican governors, to expand Medicaid, that it opened the door to increase subsidies in the private exchanges because of the savings where you have had the half the amount of people you thought you were going to have in Medicaid based on those projections, right? I mean, that's what you're arguing in terms of where the cost savings are going to be.
I'm not sure where the Republican governors come into this.
Well, they're the ones who wouldn't expand Medicaid.
Yeah.
And
right.
So they saved the federal government the money.
Right, exactly.
And that money could be shifted over to enhance the affordability.
To make
affordability.
The subsidies more affordable, yes. Right, definitely.
So now you also said that, you know, it's still by design is the wrong way to construe it, but there were still 25, 30 million people who,
by the end of this decade, who will still be uncovered.
Who will they be?
So about 40% will be people who are eligible for Medicaid but haven't signed up. And now that's not necessarily a terrible thing because those people, when they show up at a hospital emergency room or a community health center, will actually be able to get signed up on the spot. So we would like them to sign up ahead of time and get preventive services and other things that they need. But the truth is that if they really need urgent medical care, they will be able to get coverage on day one when they show up. So that's number one. The second largest group are undocumented immigrants who are not eligible for coverage, about 25%. And then the remainder fit into two buckets. One are people who can afford to buy health insurance, choose not to, and say, I'm going to pay the penalty. Massachusetts, we have every year about 40,000 people who say, I'm not going to buy health insurance, I'll pay the penalty on my taxes. That is their choice. They're not breaking the law. They're conforming with the law and taking one of the two paths available. They pay the penalty, they get nothing for it, but they're in compliance with the law. And the other group, the smaller group, but a significant number still, are people who will legitimately still not have an affordable coverage option available to them. And it's one of the groups, again, that needs to be the focus of attention moving forward.
So they will be less sort of like consciously choosing to, to pay the penalty, and more just sort of by default.
They are offered employer coverage, and it's nominally affordable to them, but in fact they can't afford it because of other requirements in their lives. And so there will still be a group of people who don't have coverage because they feel they don't have an affordable option available to them. Even through these coverages, or they may not be eligible because they have employer coverage available to them is defined as affordable.
All right, so I want to sort of shift gears here because we know that Vermont is at least attempting to head towards a single payer system.
That's a good way to put it. Attempting to head.
Yes, they have yet to figure out a funding mechanism or agree on a funding mechanism.
That's the key.
And there's some talk, you know, one of your gubernatorial candidates, at least in the Democratic primary, I think Don Berwick has floated the idea of a single payer. What if you were to advise Vermont, let's put aside the politics that have to take place, but you were to advise Vermont on how to finance, the best way to finance a single payer system, what would that be?
Well, they're doing some major behind-the-scenes, heavy, deep-dive analysis of the financing options for how to make this work. One of the things that's important, so you need taxes. You need some form of taxes to replace health insurance premiums. You come up with some nice way to say it so that you don't call it taxes, but it's essentially a tax. The key piece, the key ingredient is that whatever tax you put in place has to be eligible for the preferential tax treatment that employer health insurance premiums get. Otherwise, the state will be absorbing a huge loss by the loss of the coverage subsidy that comes through the tax treatment of employer-provided health insurance.
Can you walk me through that?
So I don't know if you get health insurance through an employer or not.
I get it through a union.
You get it through a union. Okay. So the premiums that you pay and premiums that your union pays or however it's financed are not treated as taxable income to you. And that lowers then, depending upon your tax bracket, the effective amount of money that you pay for your health insurance, you and your union pay for your health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That is the largest what's called tax expenditure in the federal government of about $350 billion a year. And
right.
Bigger than the home mortgage interest deduction, and that's the second largest, okay? So if you just get rid of employer-based coverage and say we're going to go to a fully tax-financed system, the financial benefit to the state through the federal tax treatment of health insurance, you have to structure it in a way so that you hold on to the dollar
what
value
is,
of that
what is
deduction.
What is the benefit to the state by the way that the federal tax code treats health expenditures? You mean just like literally when the state provides health insurance?
Or? So it's like, let's just say that if the cost to your union and to you and all the people like you in Vermont, let's say that was about $750 million, okay? And if...
And that reduces all of our taxable income.
Right. And if it were treated as taxable income and didn't get the deduction, let's say the cost to Vermont would be, say, $1 billion. Okay? So you'd have to raise $1 billion in taxes to replace $750 million in premiums, and you're already $250 million behind the eight ball. So part of the question is, can you structure...
So there's two costs associated with providing single-payer health insurance. Right. So one is the health insurance.
Yes.
And the other is the what you've just taken away a tax break.
You've taken away a tax break, and what you mean is then that Vermonters, if you can't do it that way, then Vermonters are shelling out, right from step one, $250 million more than they would if you just did it the old-fashioned way.
I see. So just to rephrase, one-third of the health insurance actually costs us in taxable dollars one-third less than we think it does.
Yeah, it depends on your tax. So if you're in the 15% tax break, instead of a policy costing you $10,000, it costs really $8,500.
Right.
If you're in the 33%, it costs $67,100 rather than $10,000. And it's enormous and significant. So whatever they do in Vermont, they have to make sure they hold on to that element. And that's one of the pieces they're working on very hard.
And so they have to figure out how do you create that money? I mean,
It depends. It depends what you call the new assessment and where it's located in your code. But then the challenge is this, is that doing it in a way that preserves the federal tax deductibility might make it politically less palatable to the public when they hear about it.
I see.
Because the public doesn't want to hear that it's new taxes. And plus the other piece is, you pay your piece of your premium and your union pays the rest. For the most part, you think it's about what you pay and not the whole ball of wax. And that's the way it is for most people who get coverage through their
employer.
Right,
I don't pay attention to the money that's coming
and
in
so,
from...
Right. So what happens with single payer is you take something that people for the most part don't see, and then you put it all out there in all of its glory with the full cost, and then people are going to say, well, that's too damn expensive. I can't do that. That's crazy.
So what happens in Vermont is going to be very important,
in terms of
how it is rolled out to the public, how they find the resources for it. I mean, presumably it's going to be the providing of health insurance through a single-payer system is going to end up being more cost-effective, significantly more cost-effective.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But it's hard to know how much of that savings you will have, right?
Right.
And so you're going to over-collect at the first.
If we can make it work there, it doesn't mean we can make it work anywhere. If we can't make it work there, it's going to be hard to make it work anywhere else. So this is a very important experiment. And what we see, this is part of the glory of U.S. health policy. It shifts from the feds decide to do something and they suck up all the oxygen in the room. Then they're done. And then it flips back and states start doing all kinds of experiments, right, left, center. And so we're seeing that in not just in Vermont. We're seeing it in Maryland, in Massachusetts. A whole new generation of experimentation is going on right now, mostly on the cost side.
For you as a health policy expert, what is the other – tell me another – your what you consider the most interesting experiment that's happening in
Maryland, without doubt.
And what is it that they're doing that's so...
So Maryland was the first state in the early 1970s and at one point became part of a large number of states and is now the only state still doing it that got approval to pay all their providers, hospitals, by the same set of standards and rules, whether you're in Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurance. So it's called an all-payer system. They've been running it since the 70s. It has had some significant successes. So, for example, you don't see the wild variation between what gets paid to a doctor for a Medicare enrollee versus a Medicaid enrollee versus private insurance.
So as it stands in other states, if I'm getting my knee replaced and I'm on Medicare, it's going to cost X.
Who knows?
If I'm getting my knee replaced on in Medicaid, it's going to cost Y.
Yes.
And if I'm in the private insurance, it's going to cost Z.
And it's all over the
map. We don't even know.
It's all over the map.
Right. And
So Maryland has had a system where they've had uniformity and structure and consistency and transparency. It hasn't done as well holding down the rate of cost growth, but it has had other benefits as well. So when Maryland has just gotten approval 2 weeks ago from the federal government, imagine their old system. It's like a 75 Chevy, or something like that. It's pretty old and rusty, okay? So they're taking the whole car off the chassis, and they're building a whole new car on top of that chassis that is really forward-thinking in terms of moving aggressively quickly away from paying hospitals fee-for-service rates, moving toward global payment systems, accountable care, and really building in a preventive focus in terms of their reimbursement so that not just readmissions or infections, but a whole family of bad things that happens in hospitals. Hospitals are now going to be financially accountable for that. A major effort at paying for outcomes that is, frankly, right now, the most fascinating, interesting experiment going on in the country right now, just getting underway.
So they've had this formula for years. That is basically a formula which pushed the transparency at least and added some rationality, if not cost savings.
Yes.
But now they're going to another level where they're building in where they're trying to create very specific incentives.
Yes,
with that formula.
It's a little bit like they've gone from being a Denny's. They've now gone to being kind of an Asian fusion restaurant and stuff. It's a whole different model, but inside the same building. With different purposes, different outcomes, different goals. Very exciting. Maryland's the state to watch right now.
Dr. John McDonough, Director of Center of Public Health Leadership, thanks so much for your time today.
Great to see you.
Continuing our coverage at Families USA Healthcare Health Action 2014. Joining me now is Robert Craig from Citizen Action in Wisconsin. Robert, good to see you.
Good to see you as well.
Robert, let's talk about, I want to talk something that's a little bit Wisconsin specific,
okay.
If we could. I think just my understanding is maybe today or just this week, Rush Limbaugh was stumping for your Governor Walker in Wisconsin.
Now, I had not even heard that.
Well,
I've been here all week.
Yes.
State of the State was this week. So
yes.
Walker.
Well, and in fact, today there was late breaking news that Governor Chris Christie's campaign has now been subpoenaed by the U.S. Department of Justice. So, I've been contending for some time that, you know, Governor Christie will not be running for president in 2016 because he won't get enough furlough time. But people I know in Wisconsin have told me since the beginning of this, this is the best thing to happen to Scott Walker, which could very well be the worst thing that's happened to America.
Right.
You're from Wisconsin. Do you agree? If so, elaborate.
I actually think that the political landscape in Wisconsin is littered with people who underestimated Scott Walker, that whatever you think of him ethically, and I don't have a very high opinion of him, that he is a brilliant politician, and he has worked his way up very systematically, and he always has his eye on the next thing, and his eye in being governor is to be president. And so his choices, such as doing, you know, his attack on public employee unions and instigating that those huge protests, those made him a national hero on the far right, made him Person of the Year at Human Events magazine and all the very far right publications. And so, and also his opposition to the Affordable Care Act and implementation and turning down the Medicaid money, which is very unpopular in Wisconsin, was designed for primaries, Republican primaries for the 2016 election. So even as a campaign biography, Unintimidated, which is about how he stood up against the union thugs and, you know,
right,
to save the state of Wisconsin. It was written by a former Bush speechwriter who wrote the one book-length defense of enhanced interrogation of torture. So I like to say you need that kind of talent to defend torture, to defend Scott Walker. But that's who really wrote the book, who ghostwrote the book. So Christie being, you know, by the wayside, obviously is great news for Scott Walker. And the read is, and there's some national folks who believe this too, that he uniquely, not in addition to his political talent, his access to far-right money, that he can bridge the gap between the Tea Party and the corporate part of the Republican Party that is currently divided since the shutdown. So the Chamber of Commerce and the Tea Party.
And you know, when you look at Scott Walker from outside of the state, he looks like sort of a mousy guy.
Mm-hmm.
But people who I respect in Wisconsin tell me very much what you're telling me, that he is a very shrewd politician and he does have the ability to sort of like straddle both those worlds. There was certainly some smoldering smoke in terms of investigations around Scott Walker. I haven't heard much about it over the past year, but there was a John Doe investigation, I think, this time last year.
Two of them.
And so what has happened to those investigations?
And I'd frame it this way. You know, Chris Christie's vulnerability seems to have been that he's a bully, right, and would use power ruthlessly. Walker's, quite frankly, is that he doesn't surround himself with really strong people. In fact, he surrounds himself with people who owe their jobs to him and are dog loyal. And so these scandals have all involved these people and how they operate. And so he's actually his own strategist and has full control over everything. So the first one, when he was Milwaukee County Executive, this was a John Doe investigation, his deputy chief of staff, two different ones, set up a campaign operation in the office with its own separate private router so it wouldn't be on the county internet, et cetera, a couple feet from his office. And they were never able in the investigation to fully link it to him, but it led to multiple people going to jail and being indicted and going to jail. And so, but it was so.
And
it was,
apparently, so it sounds like he promotes a certain amount of loyalty.
Very much. They all went down. You're absolutely right. And he was the first governor in Wisconsin history to have a legal defense fund. He raised national money, far right money, Koch brother money, et cetera, for the legal defense fund. Then he used it to defend his subordinates, which of course is buying their silence. But then there's a second John Doe that has to do with the recall and the protests, where they're accused of literally coordinating efforts. A huge amount of money was spent by out-of-state C4s, you know, Karl Rove-like entities,
right. Koch
brother entities. They cannot legally coordinate with a campaign. So the allegation is that that's what they were doing. It's a Republican prosecutor looking at it. There was just a setback. They had subpoenaed 12 different major state and national right-wing organizations, including the State Chamber of Commerce, on the second John Doe. And in fact, it was being leaked in the Wall Street Journal by one of their one of the members of the editorial board who used to run Club for Growth in Wisconsin. They kept leaking that this investigator was going on that was a violation of free speech. And actually, they just won a court decision quashing the subpoenas. So it's looking at this moment like John Doe 2 doesn't have a roadmap forward to get the information to prove the coordination because of that court ruling. But they hired the best lawyers in Washington, big national lawyers, in order to try to derail this investigation. So as far as I know, it's hard to see how they get the goods on him on this, but it's the same sort of smoke. There's a lot of smoke here, but it doesn't look like there at this point. Maybe this will change. It could be revelation. It's just like Christie, you didn't know, right? At this point, this investigation is going to be able to produce the goods on Governor Walker.
So, so just turning away from sort of the potential for Walker in politics on a national level in Wisconsin. What has been the fallout? I mean, I think we spoke last year or the year before.
I think both of them.
Following the massive protests in Madison, and I think there was a sense that you had that perhaps the recall as an effort might have been that energy might have been better spent. With union members going out door to door, if I recall correctly, and just sort of building support and maybe, you know, heading into the actual election that was going to happen a year or two later or whatnot. But where is the politics in Wisconsin now?
And we talked about there was a fateful decision where the read was made that you had to try to win elections to overturn what
right.
he was doing because he's so dug in. But the problem is, and this happened social movements throughout American history, you dissipate its energy and you get caught up in the structure of the election system, the money, where the races are, which isn't necessarily where all the people are, all the activists are, et cetera. And so it didn't work. It came close to working. I mean, it came within one Senate seat, and there were dynamics in those races where you could have won two of the seats that we didn't, that because of various local circumstances or candidate characteristics. But it dissipated in a lot of ways. There's still a higher level of activism. I mean, I can tell you that the pre-era before the protests and now is still dramatically different as to how easy it is to activate people and get them to do things and how much activity there is around the state. Mm. I mean, we plug into that as an organization. We've taken advantage of that. We can organize more people with fewer organizers because of that level of activism. The main problem is the state isn't really a purple state in the sense that the people are all moderate in the middle. There's a very strong red base, really headquartered around the Milwaukee suburbs, the most right-wing suburbs in the whole north of the United States, and a very strong progressive base as well, both Milwaukee, Madison, and really a lot of the medium-sized cities as well. And so they're evenly divided. They have control. They gerrymandered the state so that there were 200,000 more votes in the assembly for Democrats in 2012, and that you would have thought would produce a close majority. Instead, that produced a 60-39 Republican majority.
Wow.
And they wrote those districts with a Republican law firm. They tried to keep it all off the books and not even open
wow.
records. But that's the situation. It's impossible for progressives to take control of all three branches until redistricting because of that, which is fundamentally undemocratic. In fact, the most vulnerable is Walker himself because you can't gerrymander the state. We can't bring the Upper Peninsula of Michigan
right.
into the state. And so you have an interesting situation where you can't get immediate power for progressives, but you have a strong activated progressive base. So you have to build for the long term and to build power step by step and to block them and try to get at least one house. So it really requires perseverance and a long-term perspective because there's no quick fixes to what's going on.
Well, Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin, thanks so much for giving us that perspective on both what's happening in Wisconsin and what might come out of Wisconsin.
Thank you. And my mother and my aunt will be thrilled. They're big fans of the show.
Oh, so. Great. Glad to hear it. Thank you, Rob. Continuing our coverage at Families USA Health Action 2014, joining me now is Dr. Cheryl Phillips. She is the Senior VP for Public Policy and Advocacy of Leading Age, which is a not-for-profit aging services, an association of more than 6,000, I guess, not-for-profit aging services providers nationwide. What are those?
Great question. So when we say aging services, it's everything more traditional like nursing homes, home health, hospice, but also housing communities, affordable housing, and even community programs, things like adult day centers or meals programs or transportation. And many of our members actually do the whole continuum, which is really one of the important areas as we think about where is healthcare reform going for long-term care.
Well, how has those services provided been implicated by the Affordable Care Act?
In several ways. Most importantly, some of the new payment models. When the Affordable Care Act was put together, frankly, long-term care was not a big piece of the conversation. But those organizations that are trying to integrate services, and we've used the term accountable care organizations or bundled payment models, have started to recognize that the real answer isn't what you do in the hospital. That's important. But for vulnerable elders, it is what happens to them outside of the hospital. So the aging service continuum under the Affordable Care Act is now being looked at in very different ways. How do we look beyond nursing homes, for instance, and look to affordable housing and maybe integrate person-centered medical homes in an affordable housing community and direct services that people may need that can prevent, if not at least delay, needing to go to a nursing home. Those are some of the opportunities. The second is with care coordination and some of the innovation models, looking at better ways to coordinate complex care for people that have multiple medical problems but also have multiple functional limitations, things like the inability to take care of themselves independently or memory impairment. In prior worlds, not too long ago, in fact, in many communities right now, that often meant nursing home placement.
Uh-huh.
Many of the new models under the Affordable Care Act, both with payment and design, allow us to start to look at how do we fluidly and seamlessly direct services that people need where they need them rather than relying on institutional settings.
Because it's more efficient from a cost, cost perspective.
Potentially. Now, obviously, we can't do in-home care for everybody across the country because, frankly, I'd like somebody to come in and, you know, do my laundry and take care of stuff.
Right.
So it has to be targeted. And one area that needs lots of research is identifying those people at risk and what services do they need. So we are participating in a multi-state research evaluation looking at both HUD data, which has to do with affordable housing, and Medicare data on what kinds of medical needs and claims people have so that we can better target services. We're also working with a number of states.
So now how would you target that services? Based on a profile of a person or geography or by age? I mean, how would you target those services?
There's a number of ways of doing it. One term that's now popular in the press is hotspotting. So when I'll give an example in San Francisco. The county hospital run by the county health plan in the city of San Francisco was identifying that a number of the frail elders that were going in and out of the hospital had some common addresses. Well, maybe, and as it turned out, they worked with that affordable housing nonprofit provider, worked with a home health provider, provided some services like medication management oversight, falls prevention, coordinating doctor's visits. All of a sudden, that group ended up not being, we use the term frequent flyers, a derogatory term, but means someone who currently uses hospital services.
What?
That's one example of targeting.
Okay, so that's sort of you're targeting based upon what's deemed as a hotspot, so it's very reactionary. What was learned in that intervention as to why that was a hotspot?
It goes also back to another population that is a target population that we term the duals. And for the audience, those are those people who are both Medicaid and Medicare eligible. And the duals are a very heterogeneous group. However, as a group, they are the highest utilizers of cost and typically have the greatest burden of complex care needs. If you start looking at what does that population need, so they need transportation. They need access to care that they can get to either by phone or somebody coordinating them 24 hours a day often. They need preventive services, not just immunizations and mammograms. That's all great and wonderful. They need preventive services like overseeing how I take my medications.
Uh-huh.
Am I at risk for falls? Do I have adequate nutrition? Do I have an engagement that pulls me away from my social isolation? Because many of this group tends to be isolated in their own apartments or in their own homes. So there are ways to look at, we know what high risk criteria are. Oftentimes we don't link the known high-risk criteria to the populations that we know are out there.
So is this, when you're looking at what causes a hotspot, is it generally because you have a concentration of people who have similar education backgrounds, similar socioeconomic backgrounds, or is it like there are some really dangerous housing projects?
Mainly has to do with poverty, so socioeconomic status. And as I mentioned, those dually eligible groups who tend to be congregated in housing settings like this because they're affordable. And they, by this group, by both their financial status and also some of the medical issues that got them there
uh-huh.
tend to be a high-risk group. But there's also ways to target in communities for people that live in their own homes. It's not just affordable housing units.
What makes somebody dual eligible? They're 65 and they meet poverty thresholds?
There are several ways. You can age into it, so meet the poverty threshold and be 65, and you get your automatic Medicare card. You can also be younger if you have medical disabilities and you're on Medicare because of serious health issues. But even within that group, you can be 65 and poor and be a dual eligible and fairly able to manage your health care needs. Or you can also be with advanced dementia in a nursing home, nonverbal, totally dependent on care. So even within that continuum, we talk about the duals as if they are one group. There's a wide range of need.
Right. Interesting. So where is this heading? Is it basically, is that the sort of the leading edge of what is being researched in terms of providing long-term care, this idea of hotspotting and sort of addressing what we're finding in those hotspots?
Well, hotspotting is but one direction of this whole picture. The states are rapidly moving to recognizing when we say long-term care, most of the audience thinks of nursing homes. Long-term care is really all of the long-term supports and services across the community continuum that a person needs to live. It may be nursing homes, it may be a meals program, it may be transportation, it may be housing, it may be home nurses that come and visit. The states are rapidly moving to managed long-term supports and services payment structures. That has its own huge risks, but the opportunity is that we're having a dialogue now that if we're truly going to change the health care cost curve, as the press has often labeled it, we have to start with what we call the social determinants of health. What puts a senior at risk? Poverty, lack of education, complex medical needs, memory impairment, multiple medications, no family caregivers. There can be any number of them. So as payment starts to drive delivery system change, the real outcome of this that I think is positive is that we will start to look at how to pull services together to make real systems. And so that when we say accountable care organizations, it's not just accountable for the cost of the hospital. It's accountable for in a population that, if well cared for, can avoid the hospital in many cases.
So you want people in nursing homes to avoid the hospital. You want people in their own homes to avoid the nursing home. So-and-so, and doing this by a whole series of addressing, health problems that are potentially avoidable.
And coordinating care.
But isn't the fundamental problem in terms of the cost of healthcare in this country not a function on the demand side? I mean, you can obviously cut down on the demand for the product by sort of preventative care and whatnot and the steps you're talking about. But isn't the problem on the supply side that for whatever reasons, and there's a myriad of reasons, a hip replacement in the United States costs five times what it costs in Switzerland or whatever the sort of recent New York Times piece is. I mean, so we're seeing the costs, the problems with the cost that put us so out of sync with every other Western country in the world seems to me on the supply side rather than the demand side. I mean, of course, you can cut it down. You can cut the demand down for those hip replacements, but there doesn't seem to be anything that's controlling, you know, so they'll cost seven times more than what they cost in Switzerland.
I think it has to be both, and it's neither one nor the other. And we are struggling in this country with finance reform for healthcare or delivery reform, and I don't think you can have one without the other. The supply side is a nightmare. Frankly, not only when people get services, they are, one can argue, outrageously priced. It is not transparent to the consumer. But many of those services, one can argue, are probably not even necessary in the first place or could have been prevented. So there's a whole issue on the supply side. part of what is being addressed through the ACA and with some of the other new proposed models of payment is looking at things like bundling payment, like paying for outcomes, as we call value-based purchasing. And that's a whole nother debate. But a big piece of it is we step back and wait until bad things happen, and then we rush like heck to try to fix it.
In terms of, and that's on the demand side.
That is on the demand side. And I don't want to minimize that we have, when we look at vulnerable populations who drive much of the cost of health care, those people who have four or more chronic conditions truly are that expensive group to take care of.
Right. 80% of the costs of health care in this country are a function of 20% of the people.
And it's not just spending money on their $70,000 hip. It is also the churn that happens in and out of the healthcare system. Lots of services that probably don't need to be offered, shouldn't be offered, don't benefit the individual. And I don't mean rationing and saying you can't have something, but if you give people choices and options, very often they choose less aggressive directions. But when you identify a risk situation, that is the ultimate prevention, which addresses, as you call, the demand side.
Right. So you look at
the... So there has to be both.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I mean, I find that the vast majority of people that I speak to at this conference are focused on the demand side. And
the supply side is hard.
The supply side is a little bit more of a there's a little more controversial,
yes,
right? I mean,
right.
Because these are the people who are making the money.
That's right.
As opposed to the people who are spending it.
And I will speak for my colleagues. When you are a physician, you don't wake up in the morning and say, how many heart caths can I do? But you do believe that what I do is the right thing, so therefore I should give it to everybody. And, you know, maybe I give it to people who really need it, but maybe I give it to people who might need it. And then maybe I give it to people who want it and say they need it. Our supply side controls are very, very skewed. And if it is paid for, it's medically necessary, therefore it's paid for, therefore I want it. And it starts that circular thinking.
Right.
And perhaps,
if you're a hammer, everything's a nail.
Absolutely. And as a geriatrician, one of the things that we successfully do is push way down on the supply side because most frail elder patients don't want a lot of the things that we end up doing to them.
Interesting. And so a lot of that is about telling them, you need this.
And there's lots of ways to subtly say you need that, even without being malicious. But when you don't know what your options are, and you believe that a treatment has even a slight cure, there is a medical procedure for backs that has been proven to be no better than sham.
Yes.
My own mother said, when she had a back fracture, said, well, it's covered by Medicare, at least it's worth a try. Now, I'm a geriatrician who's in policy, and I had a difficult time explaining to my mom so she understood you really don't need to have that done. That's the challenge that we face. So some of it is on the provider side, some of it is on our lack of transparency, but there's also, it ties back to the demand side. If I can get it and it's paid for, then I should have it. And maybe I'm not informed whether or not it's actually even going to benefit me.
I mean, yeah, that just seems to be very tricky because, you know, you can talk to your mother and you have a certain authority because that's your business.
Yes.
And, you know, you're her daughter. But if your mother doesn't have a daughter who is
exactly.
a doctor, and her doctor is saying you should do this,
exactly,
and she can't come up with an argument, obviously she can't come up with a medical argument why she shouldn't do it because she's not a doctor, and cost is just one of those few things that like we can all measure the cost of, and so if there's no cost there, saying yes is not sort of a proactive move, it's just one that doesn't preclude what the doctor's saying.
It
that's what it seems to me.
Happens automatically, absolutely. So I believe that we need more evidence about what we do, and not just is an individual procedure evidence-based, but is it appropriate for that person that's in front of you?
Is there going to be any way to affect the supply side in that equation where the doctor thinks like, look, I'm a surgeon, I do back surgery, and obviously I believe it's best for everybody, you know, because otherwise why would I be in this business? Is there ever going to be a way for us to filter, to sort of control that impulse by the doctor, short of going to like a single payer system.
Form follows finance. How we pay drives what we get. Does it have to be single payer? I won't even get into the whole political controversy
right
there. But it's going to be a really uncomfortable battle for many years, because it ultimately will determine, it'll be driven by how we pay for the services that we get. Even in nursing homes, there's an outcry about excessive costs of rehab. The way it is structured is you get paid for units of rehab service. So what's the big surprise that in many nursing homes their rehab rate doubled and tripled? Did the population all of a sudden get sicker? They're paid for a unit of service, and so they believe the more they give, the better it is. Form follows finance, and until we change it, I think the ACOs will touch on it. I think some of the bundled payment models will touch on it. I think some of the recommendations with a sustainable growth rate, or SGR as we dub it, or the doc fix, will touch on it. But this is going to be a multi-level journey.
Dr. Cheryl Phillips, Senior Vice President for Public Policy and Advocacy at Leading Edge, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.